Du Bois country. It is my view, after considerable reflection, that we, all of us, black, white, male, female, gay, straight, bi, or transgender, Hispanic, Pacific Islander, African-born, of whatever complex human stew, dwell in Du Bois country. Why do I say that? Because William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, undoubtedly the premier black scholar activist of the 20th century, with the sheer power of his brilliance and his advocacy, shaped the thinking of generations with his performance, his presence, and his persistence. Simply put, Du Bois, at every significant phase of his near century of life, grappled with, grasped, and utilized the most progressive, forward-thinking, and indeed controversial ideas of his era, and to the best of his ability, pushed them further, no matter the cost. His work, therefore, moved movements and sharpened contradictions, and thereby sparked struggles both here and abroad for freedom, for national liberation, for women's equality, for black excellence, for socialism, and for a deeper meaning and definition of democracy. In these brief moments before us, I shall seek to pinpoint and example his many contributions to the gargantuan global and national struggles before us, raging throughout the 20th century and ones which continue to beckon us in the 21st. For Du Bois was many things, not least a man of the future, which he faced with hope, but a hope leavened by that prodigious intelligence, critical, unblinking, honest, reflective, ever urging us onward over the mountains of ignorance. Although it is certain that Du Bois had an enormous influence on the 20th century, it is also true that as a man born in 1868, a few dozen months after the smoke cleared from the blood-sodden fields of Antietam, Gettysburg, and Shiloh, Du Bois grew to manhood in the 19th century, and some of his age, its promise, and its betrayals, its terrors and its triumphs never left him. Indeed, his formal prose, rich and evocative, had a style and rhythm that quite distinguished him from his contemporaries. That said, Du Bois never stopped growing, learning, and expanding an already broad vision to encompass a panoramic vista of human and social possibility. That's because Du Bois, in my view, was ever an optimist. He believed in logic, in reason, in argument, in light over prejudice, bias, hatred, and narrow-mindedness. Part of this was the legacy of Harvard, a college of the elites which prized intellect above all. Part of it was Du Bois, who saw the slow yet relentless struggle of his people and working toilers of the world, pushing the world to a better, higher ground. But part of it, too, was bigger than this remarkable man. It was the evidence of all around him, from his birth to his impending death, of such social and scientific transformations as few human generations have ever seen. When Du Bois was a boy, most Americans used horses or a horse and buggy for transportation. Du Bois' lifetime saw it go to the locomotive, the auto, the plane, and rockets to the moon. He saw World Wars I and II and other such imperialist adventures as the doctrine of the divine right of white people to steal and dehumanize dark people. World War I, called the Great War by Du Bois and many of his generation before the rise of the Second World War, he termed a jealous and avaricious struggle for the largest share in exploiting the darker races. He could hardly do otherwise, for the wars were for a scramble of colonies in Africa and Asia, from which militarized colons from various European countries suctioned out wealth in unprecedented quantities, sums not seen since the heights, or perhaps more accurately, depths of slavery. The wars convinced Du Bois that the dark peoples of the world, the billions in China, India, and throughout Africa and Latino-Caribbean regions, would indeed inherit the earth and one day would be free. Du Bois and the Dark World. W.E.B. Du Bois meditated on the hundreds of millions of people outside of the U.S. who were the vast majority of humanity. In his 1941 essay, The Future of the Negro State University, published in The Education of Black People, Du Bois makes this explicit, stating, "Most men in this world are colored. a belief in humanity means a belief in colored men. And lest we make invisible the vast segment, indeed majority of humanity that is female, doubt not that he was inclusive of that number, as shall be seen below. For Du Bois, his firmest hope was that the oppressed millions of Africa, Asia, and the Latino Caribbean world would make common cause with their black American relatives, then known as Negroes, and that these forces would people and remake the world. It was in this spirit that he published his first major work of fiction in 1928, his 60th year of life. It was entitled Dark Princess, a Romance. Here, Du Bois imagines a love match between a black American and an Indian princess who join not only in love, but in struggle against British conquest and imperialism. It is, by any measure, a remarkable work, as it gives scope to Du Bois' erotic life and his love of the beauty of dark women. It is also propaganda in the long war against oppression, for under the eroticism lies the union of two dark peoples, ones held in thrall to Britain and the Americans, and who resent and struggle against this binding, repressive grasp. When mainstream reviewers attack the work as propaganda, Du Bois could offer a ready response. In the crisis of 1926, he explained his position, one which could hopefully find fruit in today's rap and hip-hop artists and producers. All art is propaganda, he said, and ever must be, despite the wailing of the purists. I stand in utter shamelessness and say that whatever art I have for writing has been used always for propaganda, for gaining the right of black folk to love and enjoy. Not content with that general statement of his position, Du Bois slammed down the exclamation point. I do not care a damn for any art that is not used for propaganda. One needs to look far and wide today for such an expression of art's role, driven as it is by corporatism and gluttony for profit. For the dark world, near and far, Du Bois' pen was at its service, in fiction, editorials, in essays, and criticism for generations. From 1900 intermittently to 1945, Du Bois helped organize Pan-African congresses, which drew some of the finest minds and stalwart hearts from the continent and diaspora. He, by the 1940s, saw the beginnings, the stirrings, of a unity of mind that could support liberation movements to come. In an address to black college students, Du Bois explained his views. There is, as yet, no great single centralizing of thought or unification of opinion, but there are centers which are growing larger and touching edges. The most significant centers of this new thinking are, perhaps naturally, outside Africa and in America, in the United States and in the West Indies. This is followed by South Africa and West Africa, and then more vaguely by South America, with faint beginnings in East Central Africa, Nigeria, and the Sudan. The Pan-African movement, when it comes, will not, however, be merely a narrow racial propaganda. Already the more far-seeing Negroes sense the coming unities, a unity of the working classes everywhere, a unity of the colored races, a new unity of thinking men. Now, what precisely did Du Bois mean regarding a unity of the colored races? He explains, in a conscious sense of unity among colored races, there is today only a growing interest. This is slowly arising not only a curiously strong brotherhood of Negro blood throughout the world, but the common cause of the darker races against the intolerable assumptions and insults of Europeans has already found expression. The future world will, in all reasonable probability, be what colored men make it. Thus we see, Du Bois saw the emergence of the dark world as the antidote to colonialism, imperialism, and as a necessary ingredient in the black liberation movement. He worked long and hard to bring it into being. Du Bois, feminist. W.E.B. Du Bois, much like his distinguished predecessor, Frederick Douglass, believed firmly, one may say deeply, in the equality of women. Indeed, reading his work, we find an adoration, a deep love of black women and other dark women for their beauty, strength, and character. In Darkwater, to this reader, his finest, most passionate, and most militant nonfiction work, Du Bois writes extensively of women's oppression by backward social forces and ideas. In this proto-feminist essay, The Damnation of Women, Du Bois writes, "In microcosm, and with differences emphasizing sex equality, is the industrial history of labor in the 19th and 20th centuries. We cannot abolish the new economic freedom of women. We cannot imprison women again in a home or require them all on pain of death to be nurses and housekeepers. The uplift of women is, next to the problem of the color line and the peace movement, our greatest modern cause. When now two of these movements, women and color, combine in one, its combination has deep meaning." Again, in Darkwater, Du Bois writes of the primal black all-mother of men down through the ghostly throng of mighty womanhood who walked in the mysterious dawn of Asia and Africa. Du Bois then does a roll call of dark female eminence from antiquity to the 20th century thus. From Neith, the primal mother of all, whose feet rest on hell and whose almighty hands uphold the heavens, all religion, from beauty to beast, lies on her eager breasts. Her body bears the stars, while her shoulders are necklaced by the dragon. From Black Neith down to that starred Ethiop queen who strove to set her beauty's praise above the sea nymphs, through dusky Cleopatras, dark Candaces, and darker, fiercer Zingas, to our own day and our own land, in gentle Phyllis, Harriet the crude Moses, the Sibyl Sojourner Truth, and the martyr Luis de Morte. The father and his worship is Asia. Europe is the precocious, self-centered, forward-striving child, but the land of the mother is and was Africa. Here then is Du Bois at the apex of his middle life, writing of women with a rare, uncommon voice, with reverence. He doubtless foresaw the rise and emergence of women as a liberating force of social power to truly transform society. A Du Boisian future? Du Bois was far more than a scholar. He was an activist, a revolutionary, who used his considerable gifts to bring a new future into being through ceaseless agitation and critique of the state, its political representation, and his contemporaries whom he thought in error or in betrayal of the highest aspirations of the dark world. He therefore thought seriously about the future of black Americans and what role they would or should play in the world to come. At the dawn of the 1960s, in the shattering aftermath of the Second World War, many of Europe's former colonies had slipped her grasp and begun the long trek toward independence. Internally, then American Negroes were moving towards their long-coveted citizenship almost a century after constitutional promises. For Du Bois, this presented as many problems as opportunities. For what did citizenship really mean for black folk in the heart of a white empire? In many ways, these are issues we have still not resolved. For Du Bois viewed U.S. blacks as an international people, part of America to be sure, but part of Africa too. What would he make of a dark president, son of a continental African, unleashing death and destruction on dark lands, indeed on African soil itself? Du Bois, in his bones, was a race man, and that he ever saw the world, as he put it, through the veil, that is, through black eyes. But he also was, especially in his later years, a staunch anti-imperialist who opposed U.S. adventures abroad for its unmitigated violence against dark nations. In the last decade of his life, he took up the mantle of world peace, chairing the Peace Information Center in New York, where he fought for the abolition of nuclear weapons. In one of his last essays, written 3 years before his death, he makes clear that citizenship of black folks doesn't mean surrender of one's racial identity, one's views, or one's political convictions. In Whither, Now, and Why, 1960, Du Bois asks, what does this new legal citizenship mean? And answers through his own tortured experience. For 45 years, on and off, Du Bois organized and supported Pan-African congresses, But by 1960, he admitted that he could get but little support and cooperation from American Negroes. Among his people, he found resentment and weariness of what such global struggles could entail. Interestingly, this was not the response one found among the most enlightened segments of African thinkers. Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of an independent Ghana, as early as 1958, would name two major figures in Black America as instrumental and inspirational in the African freedom movements, Marcus Mosiah Garvey and W.E.B. Du Bois. Said Nkrumah, long before many of us were conscious of our own degradation, these men fought for African national and racial equality. As Pan-Africanist, anti-imperialist, socialist, communist, and internationalist, it is inconceivable that Du Bois, were he alive today, would or could support the Iraq wars, the Afghanistan invasion, or the U.S.-NATO bombings in Libya. Of course, if he were alive today, he'd be about 144 years old, but I'm just saying. A Du Boisian future would see less war, less imperial adventures into the dark world, and of course, less neocolonialism. Du Bois saw the rise of dark world, of China, of India, and hoped for far more African progress in economic and political spheres. In this age, marked by the emergence of the Occupy movement against imperial wars and the rapaciousness of capital, Du Bois would be right at home. Consider his pungent critique of U.S. rulers, who were, he said, instead of being individuals, are organized corporations who suppress freedom by monopolizing wealth. Are you disturbed or angered at the vast sums of money raised for national presidential elections? Du Bois was too, and scored the Eisenhower election for wasting between $100 and $200 million in pursuit of power. Although these sums are today seen as almost infinitesimal, Du Bois' questions are as relevant today as they were half a century ago. Why does America need such an election fund? A Democratic election doesn't need it. And the United States needed and used it only for bribing voters directly and indirectly, or frightening men from acting and thinking. Decades ago, Du Bois saw the looming deficits of the American public school system, which, although the gift of black folk in the Reconstruction South in later years, would drop out incredible numbers of dark children, many of whom would live miserable half-lives, with college not even a serious consideration. And as far back as 1938, Du Bois would boldly call for socialized medicine and condemn the American Medical Association, which fights with huge funds every effort to bring free government-supported social medicine to the service of the people. Imagine what his stance would be on today's so-called healthcare controversy. Across the ocean of time, we see Du Bois, a fighter for the poor, the oppressed, the dark world, the black world, fighting for a better, larger future. The Du Boisians. Since his passage into the realm of ancestor in 1963, Du Bois has had his fair share of spiritual descendants. Of course, his son David Du Bois has been an author, scholar, and activist. Perhaps none has more fully embraced that role as has Angela Y. Davis. Her life as scholar, activist, revolutionary, communist leader, radical icon, political prisoner, and prison abolitionist may indeed exceed his in its rich depth and intensity of dissent. A study of her work reflects the deep influence of Du Bois, the indentation of a trail that Davis has trod and taken further. The same might be said of Cornel West, who, like Du Bois, a Harvard man, writes, speaks, and acts in social movements far beyond the ivy towers of academia. And though West may depart from Du Bois in his expressions of religiosity, West is, among other things, a theologian, his use and embrace of culture is a classic hallmark of Du Bois. What brings West closest to Du Bois, however, is his disposition for dissent, both in his public and principled critique of the Obama administration's foreign, domestic, and economic policies, and his willingness to contest contradictions in the realms of academia. The late Manning Marable also had some of the flair and panache of Du Bois, for as an administrator of a major American Ivy League university, he established African and African-American study programs that touched and expanded many black, dark, and American lives. He was also a scholar of the first rank, who lived a life both of scholar activism and academic black excellence. His work, some consider this his masterpiece, How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America, although an homage to West Indian scholar Walter Rodney, was a Du Boisian task in spirit, if not in name. And last, and certainly not least, your professor, Tony Montero, is as Du Boisian as they come. From his youth as a radical activist to his political opposition and candidacy during the dark days and nights of the Rizzo era to this very hour, indeed, this very event in this university, we see the potent influence of Du Bois. And there are men and women laboring in the vineyards of academia and beyond who are continuing Du Boisian work as independent scholars, committed activists, bearers of an ancient flame that continues to give light in the darkness, the undiscovered country. There is a saying, no man knows what tomorrow may bring. Du Bois, as brilliant as he undoubtedly was as historian, sociologist, scholar, activist, journalist, columnist, editor, critic, and revolutionary, did not know the future, yet he tried to turn its tide to his will. He sought with all his heart, his magnificent mind, and his fearsome will to turn time's trajectory in favor of the dark world, the vast majority of humanity. To that end, his pen and his tongue were weapons to protect and defend the black, brown, and yellow worlds from assault and attack from the West. Yet, it takes two to tango. And if you attack the empire, guess what? The empire strikes back. When noting the Du Boisians, I remarked on Angela Y. Davis's deeper, richer experience, in large part because of her political imprisonment and hounding stemming from the San Rafael courthouse shootout back in 1970, in which the brother of George Jackson, Jonathan, and several other black revolutionaries were killed. Although acquitted of all charges, she experienced imprisonment, which Du Bois did not. Yet this was not for lack of the state's trying. I have said Du Bois led the International Peace Center in New York back in 1950, an anti-nuclear weapons group. From his acceptance of that role, he was targeted by the Justice Department and had his passport seized for nearly a decade. He was indicted on charges of being an agent of a foreign government and tried in 1951. And although acquitted, the trial cost him over $30,000 in legal and court costs. As Du Bois writes, this sum I and my wife had to beg from state to state. Of the case itself and its aftermath, Du Bois would later write, the court threw the case out for lack of proof. Despite this, I was refused a passport for travel abroad until the Supreme Court finally decided that the Department of State had no legal ground to refuse me a passport. I have said Du Bois did not suffer the pains of imprisonment, as had Dr. Davis. Yet, for this global figure and world traveler, the denial of a passport led to what Du Bois described thusly. For 9 years, I was imprisoned in the confines of the United States by the unauthorized dictum of those who were ruling. So it seems there are various kinds of imprisonment. That said, the experience taught Du Bois who his real friends were. Hounded by the government, battered by the press, in the midst of the Red Scare, his fair-weather friends of rank, wealth, and class deserted him, virtually en masse. For working people, for the poor but literate people, who read him in barbershops and taverns, Du Bois was their hero, and they loved him. They raised the money that he needed to battle in court. Among many of us, radicalism is the emblem of youth, and conservatism is the preserve of elders. Not so Du Bois, who became more radical as his life lengthened. His legal struggles radicalized him, as it distanced him from polite society. Like his colleague, Paul Robeson, their names appeared less and less, both in the corporate and the Negro press. Yet Du Bois marched on. In his 1933 essay, The Field and Function of the Negro College, Du Bois ended with a challenge, let us be insane with courage. He put his money where his mouth was. In 1961, he moved to Nkrumah's Ghana in West Africa and renounced his American citizenship. He became a citizen of Ghana in 1963, the same year he joined the Communist Party. And even though it was the year of his translation to ancestor, it marked his courage and his willingness to join and merge with the dark world. His life became a prodigious example of radical and revolutionary commitment to the building of a new day and a new world against empire. Rightly has his work continued to influence and inform us to this late age. We dwell in a world that he labored for and dreamt of. There are many, many struggles left unwon. But in Du Bois, we have much more than mere inspiration. For he was the Black Print. For imprisoned nation, I thank you. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.